working full-time as a kindergarten teacher and getting up at 4 a.m. to wash her family's clothes before she was due at work. What happened? Alyssa's worldview changed, and the system in which she lived changed. It all began when Miss Miller, the principal of the local school, hired Alyssa to work part-time as a teacher's aide. Miss Miller soon observed that Alyssa had natural teaching gifts and took the time to encourage her to get the education and certification required to pursue a teaching career. With Miss Miller's relational and nurturing approach, Alyssa began to gain confidence. And while her worldview was changing, two important changes also occurred in Alyssa's economic environment. First, Congress passed welfare reform legislation, making welfare more pro-work and placing limits on the length of time people could stay on it. Alyssa knew her days on welfare were coming to an end and that she simply had to find a full-time job. Second, Miss Miller offered Alyssa a job as a full-time teacher, thereby making the economic system finally work for Alyssa. Churches are uniquely positioned to provide the relational ministries on an individual level that people like Alyssa need. While making major changes to national and international economic systems is more difficult, churches can often make just enough changes in local systems to allow people like Alyssa to move out of material poverty. Such systemic change can take on the form of political advocacy. But more often, it simply means changing the economic options for the materially poor so that they have an opportunity to support themselves. For example, business owners in your church could provide jobs for poor people, giving them a rare opportunity to make a fresh start. Or your church might hire poor people part-time, giving them practical experience and an opportunity to develop strong work habits that can lead to full-time employment elsewhere. Of course, churches can also offer Alyssa something that Miss Collins could not: a clear articulation of the gospel of the kingdom, so that Alyssa can experience the profound and lasting change required to achieve material poverty alleviation in its fullest sense. The ability to fulfill her calling of glorifying God through her work and life. Parts 2 and 3 of this book will elaborate further on ways the church can address both individuals and the systems in which they live in order to be ministers of reconciliation. Part 2: General Principles for Helping Without Hurting. Chapter 4: Not All Poverty is Created Equal. You turn on the evening news, and you see that a tsunami has devastated Indonesia, leaving millions without food, adequate clothing, or shelter. Following a commercial break, the news returns and features a story about the growing number of homeless men in your city who are also without food, adequate clothing, or shelter. At first glance, the appropriate responses to each of these crises might seem to be very similar. The people in both situations need food, clothing, and housing, and providing these things to both groups seems to be the obvious solution. But there is something nagging in us as we reflect on these two news stories. Deep down, it seems like the people in these two crises are in very different situations and require different types of help. How should we think about these scenarios? Are there principles to guide us to the appropriate response in each case? Pick a number between 1 and 3. A helpful first step in thinking about working with the poor in any context is to discern whether the situation calls for relief, rehabilitation, or development. In fact, the failure to distinguish among these situations is one of the most common reasons that poverty alleviation efforts often do harm. Relief can be defined as the urgent and temporary provision of emergency aid to reduce immediate suffering from a natural or man-made crisis. When a crisis such as the Indonesian tsunami strikes, people are nearly or even completely helpless and experiencing plummeting economic conditions. There is a need to halt the freefall, to stop the bleeding, and this is what relief attempts to do. The key feature of relief is a provider-receiver dynamic, in which the provider gives assistance, often material, to the receiver, who is largely incapable of helping himself at that time. The Good Samaritan's bandaging of the helpless man who lay bleeding along the roadside is an excellent example of relief applied appropriately. Rehabilitation begins as soon as the bleeding stops. It seeks to restore people and their communities to the positive elements of their pre-crisis conditions. The key feature of rehabilitation is a dynamic of working with the tsunami victims as they participate in their own recovery. Development is a process of ongoing change that moves all the people involved, both the helpers and the helped, closer to being in right relationship with God, self, others, and the rest of creation. In particular, as the materially poor develop, they are better able to fulfill their calling of glorifying God by working and supporting themselves and their families with the fruits of that work. Development is not done to people or for people, but with people. The key dynamic in development is promoting an empowering process in which all of the people involved, both the helpers and the helped, become more of what God created them to be, moving to levels of reconciliation that they have not experienced before. It is absolutely crucial that we determine whether relief, rehabilitation, or development is the appropriate intervention. One of the biggest mistakes that North American churches make, by far, is in applying relief in situations in which rehabilitation or development is the appropriate intervention. The Good Samaritan's handouts were appropriate for the person, a victim who needed material assistance to stop the bleeding and even prevent death. However, the person not facing an emergency and handouts of material assistance to such people do not help to restore them to being the productive stewards that they were created to be. In fact, as we saw in Chapter 2, applying a material solution to the person whose underlying problem, like ours, is relational, is likely to do harm to this person and to the provider of the material assistance, exacerbating the brokenness in the four key relationships for both of them. The remainder of this chapter uses the relief, rehabilitation, development paradigm to flesh out some principles as we seek the goal of poverty alleviation, low-income people, and ourselves increasingly glorifying God through reconciling relationships with God, self, others, and the rest of creation. Who's number one? Many of the people coming to your church for help will state that they are in a crisis, needing emergency financial help for utility bills, rent, food, or transportation. Is relief the appropriate intervention for such a person? Maybe, but maybe not. There are several things to consider. First, is there really a crisis at hand? If you fail to provide immediate help, will there really be serious negative consequences? If not, then relief is not the appropriate intervention, for there is time for the person to take actions on his own behalf. Second, to what degree was the individual personally responsible for the crisis? Of course, compassion and understanding are in order here, especially when one remembers the systemic factors that can play a role in poverty. But it is still important to consider the person's own culpability in the situation, as allowing people to feel some of the pain resulting from any irresponsible behavior on their part can be part of the tough love needed to facilitate the reconciliation of poverty alleviation. The point is not to punish the person for any mistakes or sins he has committed, but to ensure that the appropriate lessons are being learned in the situation. Third, can the person help himself? If so, then a pure handout is almost never appropriate, as it undermines the person's capacity to be a steward of his own resources and abilities. Fourth, to what extent has this person already been receiving relief from you or others in the past? How likely is he to be receiving such help in the future? As special as your church is, it might not be the first stop on the train. This person may be obtaining emergency assistance from one church or organization after another, so that your just this one-time gift might be the 10th such gift the person has recently received. My family experienced this situation 2 months ago when a young woman knocked on the door of our house asking for some food. We complied. But we later found out that she had received similar assistance from other members of our community for many weeks, and we still see her going door to door asking for food. When neighbors have sought to provide her with long-term solutions, she has refused such help. The loving thing to do for this woman is for the entire community to withhold further relief, to explain our reason for doing so, and to offer her wide open arms should she choose a path of walking together with us in finding long-term solutions. While many of these rules of thumb strike an intuitive chord when working with the materially poor in North America, many of us ignore these principles when working with the materially poor in the majority world. Compared to our own situation, the levels of poverty in the majority world seem so devastating, and the people seem so helpless. In such contexts, many of us are quick to hand out money and other forms of relief assistance in ways that we would never even consider when ministering to the poor in North America. To illustrate, consider the Savings and Credit Association affiliated with Jehovah Jireh Church, a congregation located in a slum in Manila, the Philippines. Each of the members of this Savings and Credit Association live on approximately $1 to $5 per day. Each member of the association deposits into the group just 20 cents per week, which the association uses to make very small, interest-bearing loans to the members. In addition, each member contributes 5 cents per week to the association's emergency fund, which can be used to provide relief to members facing an emergency crisis. From a North American perspective, these people are extremely poor. In this light, it is instructive to consider the policies that the Savings and Credit Association developed for its emergency fund. Money from the fund is lent, not given, at a 0% interest rate to group members whose family members get sick. No assistance is available for people who have had their electricity or water cut off for not paying their utility bills. According to the group, such a situation does not constitute an emergency, since electric and water bills are regular household expenditures for which they should all be prepared. The group will not even give emergency loans for hospitalization for giving birth, because the family had 9 months to prepare for the delivery of the baby. Finally, the amount of the loan from the emergency fund is limited to the amount of the savings contributions of the member getting the loan. The members of this Savings and Credit Association are tough cookies. Now, what happens when a North American church encounters the members of Jehovah Jireh Church's Savings and Credit Association? We often project our own ideas of what is an acceptable standard of living onto the situation and are quick to take a relief approach, doling out money in ways that the local people would consider unwise and dependence-creating. And in the process, we can undermine local judgment, discipline, accountability, stewardship, savings, and institutions. In fact, research has shown that the injection of outside funds into these savings and credit groups typically dooms them to collapse. The point here is not that the policies of Jehovah Jireh's Savings and Credit Association are normative for all churches in all contexts. The point is that in deciding if relief is the appropriate intervention, we must be careful lest we impose our own cultural assumptions into contexts that we do not understand very well. Assessment tools can help you to discern the nature of a person's situation. These tools can range from an informal set of questions used in an initial conversation to a more formal and detailed written form. Such assessment tools help to identify the type of assistance that would be most beneficial and can also help to determine if the need for help is real. Furthermore, these tools can reveal the willingness of the person to address larger life issues that may have contributed to the present situation. It is helpful for your church or ministry to have a set of benevolence policies in place to guide decision-making when working with materially poor people. These policies should flow from your mission and vision and be consistent with a biblical perspective on the nature of poverty and its alleviation. Who is number one? It is unlikely that you know many people in this category, for the reality is that only a small percentage of the poor in your community or around the world require relief. These would include the severely disabled, some of the elderly, very young, orphaned children, the mentally ill homeless population, and victims of a natural disaster. People in these categories are often unable to do anything to help themselves and need the handouts of relief. However, for most people, the bleeding has stopped, and they are not destitute. Acting as though they are destitute does more harm than good, both to them and to ourselves. This does not mean that we should do nothing to help those who are not destitute. It just means that rehabilitation or development, not relief, is the appropriate way of helping such people. This could very well include providing them with financial assistance. But such assistance would be conditional upon and supportive of their being productive. Chapters 8 and 9 provide examples of interventions that do this by complementing people's work and thrift with additional resources. How do you spell effective relief? If you do determine that relief is the appropriate response in a given situation, there are some principles that can help to make your relief efforts more effective. First, relief needs to be immediate. If a person is in the midst of a crisis and cannot help himself, a timely response is crucial. For example, when a large-scale natural disaster hits, the victims cannot wait weeks while churches try to think of what they should do and secure funding. What is true for large-scale disasters is true for the battered woman who has bravely come to the church office seeking safe shelter. Sending her back home to wait while the church tries to find her some alternative shelter is not a good relief response. In order to provide timely relief, it is important to engage in disaster preparedness. This simply means looking ahead and forecasting the types of relief situations that the church or ministry may encounter. Financial, material, and human resources can be identified and secured to be ready to put into play at the right time. For example, the deacons can ensure that the church either obtains or creates a directory of services that are available in the community to address relief needs. The deacons can also line up people within the congregation who would be ready to give of themselves to help someone who is in the midst of a crisis. Such help could include opening their home for a few nights, providing transportation to an agency, taking a person out to eat, or working in the church's clothing closet to ensure it is well organized. Second, relief is also temporary, provided only during the time that people are unable to help themselves. Unfortunately, determining when to stop relief is never easy. On the one hand, we can make the mistake of ending our assistance too early. An uninsured family facing ongoing medical bills due to a health emergency may need more than a single gift of $100 from the church's benevolence fund. On the other hand, if relief is given for too long, it can do harm by creating dependence. Again, your church needs to have benevolence policies in place that define the degree, frequency, and length of relief efforts. While there may be occasions that call for working outside of these policies, having such policies can greatly aid in providing relief appropriately. How do you spell effective relief? SELDOMIMMEDIATE and TEMPORARY. Seldom, immediate, and temporary. Doing relief and rehabilitation developmentally. Once relief efforts have stopped the bleeding, it is time to move quickly into rehabilitation, working with, not for, people to help them return to the positive elements of their pre-crisis conditions. Again, rehabilitation must be done in a way consistent with the long-run goal of poverty alleviation. Low-income people and ourselves increasingly glorifying God through reconciling relationships with God, self, others, and the rest of creation. About 20 years ago, my wife and I helped to mobilize our church to volunteer at a Christian homeless shelter. Most of the men living in the shelter had experienced some sort of trauma, such as a divorce, a death in the family, or a loss of a job. Turning to drugs or alcohol to ease the pain, these men had lost everything and needed emergency help to survive in the frigid conditions of the Connecticut winter. By providing food and warm beds, the shelter had stopped the downward plunge for these men and was now trying to help them to rehabilitate through a range of counseling services. Once a month, the members of our church graciously bought food, prepared a meal, and served it to the shelter residents, and cleaned up afterward. We did everything short of spoon-feeding the men, never asking them to lift a finger in the entire process. A more developmental approach would have sought greater participation of these men in their own rehabilitation, asking them to exercise stewardship as part of the process of beginning to reconcile their key relationships. We could have involved the men every step along the way, from planning the meal to shopping for the food, to helping with serving and cleanup. We could have done supper with the men, working and eating side by side, rather than giving supper to the men, engaging in a provider-recipient dynamic that likely confirmed our sense of superiority and their sense of inferiority. Doing rehabilitation and even relief using a more developmental approach is now considered the best practice in the field. For example, the Minimum Standards of Disaster and Rehabilitation Assistance includes the following guidelines, to which we've added some comments. Ensure participation of the affected population in the assessment, design, implementation, monitoring, and evaluation of the assistance program. This is the equivalent of saying that the men in the homeless shelter need to be involved in every aspect of not just preparing supper, but in the design, implementation, and evaluation of the entire homeless shelter's programs. Does this sound crazy? Clearly, judgment is necessary to determine the capacity of the target population to make wise decisions and to shoulder responsibilities. But it is important to work from a perspective that we are all created in the image of God, that we are all broken, and that we all can experience Christ's reconciliation. As much as possible, we need to treat people as the responsible stewards that we want them to be, even asking their opinions once in a while. Homeless men might actually know something about, well, being homeless. Conduct an initial assessment to provide an understanding of the disaster situation and to determine the nature of the response. This is a little different from loading up a truck of volunteers from your church and running down to New Orleans the day after the levees break. It requires you to know the local context and situation, or to be working under the auspices and coordination of those who do. Respond when needs of an affected population are unmet by local people or organizations due to their inability or unwillingness to help. Note how cautious this approach is. If local people and organizations are able and willing to help those in the crisis, then stay away. the local people will typically have a better understanding of the best way to get the job done. Moreover, the entire goal of development work is for local people to take charge of their individual lives and communities. Rushing in with all sorts of outside knowledge and resources can undermine the four key relationships in that community, one of which is being a steward of the rest of creation. If they need help, give it. But if they do not, your giving may do harm. From a biblical perspective, we need to qualify this best practice guideline a bit. Whenever possible, the first responders to a crisis should be the victim's family members, whether those family members are geographically local or not. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 3 through 4. However, in many relief situations, there is not sufficient time to involve the family members, particularly if they live far away from the crisis. In such situations, the geographically local people should become the first responders. Target assistance based on vulnerability and need, and provide it equitably and impartially. Note the concern here with precision, making sure that the people who get the assistance are truly vulnerable and needy. Flinging resources around undermines the development of individual and communal stewardship, responsibility, and capacity. The women in the Savings and Credit Association of Jehovah Jireh Church understood this quite well. Aid workers must possess appropriate qualifications, attitudes, and experience to plan and effectively implement appropriate assistance programs. Note the concern here is with both ability and attitude. There are complex disaster situations in which untrained volunteers are more of a hindrance than a help, particularly when they are not working under the auspices of an experienced organization. Again, jumping in a truck and heading down to New Orleans during a major disaster might do more harm than good. And an attitude of humility and brokenness is everything. The provider-receiver dynamic in the relief situation lends itself to all of the problems we have discussed concerning the God complexes of the providers interacting with the recipient's feeling of inferiority. And the dangers are even greater in rehabilitation contexts, in which the recipients have the capacity to participate in their own recovery. In such settings, top-down, "I am here to save you" attitudes can seriously undermine the development of the recipient's initiative and stewardship. Bad relief undermines worship. The sprawling Kibera slum of Nairobi, Kenya, is believed to be the largest slum in Africa. Development workers commonly refer to Kibera as scorched earth, because decades of well-meaning outside organizations have made it nearly impossible to do long-lasting development work there. Failing to recognize that the appropriate intervention in Kibera is neither relief nor rehabilitation, outside organizations have poured in financial and human resources, crippling local initiative in the process. Alvin Mimbola, a Kenyan community development worker who tries to build up the indigenous churches in Kibera, describes the situation as follows. To many people, the Kibera slum in Nairobi, Kenya, is a place with no equals. It is filthy, congested, degraded, and unfit for human habitation. Like the proverbial scriptural reference to the birthplace of Jesus Christ, many people believe that nothing good can come out of Kibera. Therefore, most remedies directed towards Kibera are motivated by the sympathy of outsiders, who often give handouts in an attempt to cushion the residents against their perceived gigantic problems. In reality, many of the problems of Kibera stem from chronic issues that can only be solved through a consistent and long-term relationship between the change agent and the residents. Changes within individuals and communities are not instantaneous. Long-term relationships are needed to bring out the best of what is and of what could be. The people in Kibra have capacities, skills, and resources that need to be tapped if genuine development is to be realized. But the process of identifying and mobilizing these gifts and assets takes time. Unfortunately, for many years, non-government organizations working in Kibra have tended to operate on the basis of quick fixes. Frustration set in because changes in individuals are not forthcoming as quickly as anticipated. Many of these organizations then either closed down or moved to other parts of the country, leaving people in a worse situation than they were before. In the process, individual and community lives have been devastated. It appears that many donors are willing to give to any venture as long as they see pictures of dilapidated Kibra. Of course, there are some occasions in which there is a need for relief work in Kibra. For example, oftentimes there are fire breakouts where houses and business premises are gutted down. It might be necessary to bring in outside resources to provide relief and to rehabilitate these homes and businesses. But even in these situations, caution should be taken so that the relief efforts are not prolonged to the point in which they undermine local people's stewardship of their own lives and communities. The root issue in all of these considerations is that God, who is the worker, ordained work so that humans could worship Him through their work. Relief efforts applied inappropriately often cause the beneficiaries to abstain from work, thereby limiting their relationship with God through distorted worship or through no worship at all. The poison of paternalism. Are you feeling overwhelmed yet? Poverty alleviation is more complex than it appears at first glance. However, there is a good rule of thumb that is extremely useful in cutting through a lot of the complexity. Avoid paternalism. Do not do things for people that they can do for themselves. Memorize this. Recite it under your breath all day long and wear it like a garland around your neck. Every time you are engaged in poverty alleviation ministry, keep this at the forefront of your mind, for it can keep you from doing all sorts of harm. Paternalism comes in a variety of forms. Resource paternalism. Resource paternalism has been discussed in this book at some length already. Being from a materialistic culture, North Americans often view the solution to poverty in material terms and tend to pour financial and other material resources into situations in which the real need is for the local people to steward their own resources. In addition, legitimate local businesses can be undermined when outsiders bring in such things as free clothes or building supplies, undercutting the price that these local businesses need to survive. Spiritual paternalism. Spiritual paternalism has also been discussed earlier. Many of us assume that we have a lot to teach the materially poor about God, and that we should be the ones preaching from the pulpit, teaching the Sunday school class, or leading the vacation Bible school. We do have much to shout out of our knowledge and experiences, but oftentimes the materially poor have an even deeper walk with God, and have insights and experiences that they can share with us if we would just stop talking and listen. Knowledge paternalism. Knowledge paternalism occurs when we assume that we have all the best ideas about how to do things. As a result, the materially poor need us to think for them concerning the best way to plant crops, to operate their businesses, or to cure diseases. Handling knowledge is a very tricky area in poverty alleviation, because the truth is that we often do have knowledge that can help the materially poor. But we must recognize that the materially poor also have unique insights into their own cultural contexts and are facing circumstances that we do not understand very well. For example, during the first several decades after World War II, the leading Western economists and agriculturalists concluded that peasant farmers in the majority world were irrational and culturally backward because the farmers failed to adopt new varieties of crops that had higher average yields. Subsequent research discovered that the farmers were, indeed, acting very rationally. While the new crop varieties had higher average yields, these new crops also had much greater variation in their yields from year to year than the farmers' traditional varieties. For farmers living in highly vulnerable situations, in which a bad crop could result in starvation for their children, it was better to choose the low-risk, low-return traditional varieties than the high-risk, high-return new varieties, particularly in a setting in which landlords and loan sharks tended to reap the majority of any increase in profits. The failure of the outside experts to understand the realities of life on the ground led them to give life-threatening advice to the materially poor, and then to demean the poor when they failed to listen to this expert advice. All of us need to remember that the materially poor really are created in the image of God and have the ability to think and to understand the world around them. They actually know something about their situation, and we need to listen to them. This does not need to degenerate into some sort of New Age, "the truth is within you" quagmire. Like all of us, the materially poor are often wrong about how the world works and can benefit from the knowledge of others. In fact, a key trigger point for change in a community is often being exposed to a new way of understanding or of doing something. But it is reflective of a God complex to assume that we have all the knowledge and that we always know what is best. Knowledge paternalism may be a particular temptation for Christian business people from North America, many of whom are showing considerable passion for using their God-given abilities to train low-income entrepreneurs in the majority world. This passion is a wonderful development and has enormous potential to advance Christ's kingdom around the world. But the fact that a person successfully operates a software company in Boston does not ensure that this person has the best business advice for a highly vulnerable cassava farmer living on $1 per day in the semi-feudal institutional setting of rural Guatemala. Humility, caution, and an open ear are in order. Similarly, pastors of middle to upper class North American churches may be susceptible to knowledge paternalism, making the mistake of thinking that their own ministry styles are normative for all cultural settings. Churches of different socioeconomic classes, even within North America, differ dramatically in terms of the ways that they handle money, prayer, sermons, staffing, music, membership, counseling, etc. For example, in a lower-class church, prayers tend to be participatory, with individual members praying for God to heal specific problems that they are having. In contrast, in middle-class churches, the pastor tends to offer the prayers, asking God more generally to help those who are sick. Finally, in wealthy churches, prayers are often done through highly stylized liturgy. Wherever the Bible speaks specifically about church life, it must be heeded. But where the Bible is silent, North American pastors must be careful not to impose their own culturally determined ministry styles into settings in which the local pastors might know more about the most effective way to minister. Labor paternalism. Labor paternalism occurs when we do work for people that they can do for themselves. I remember going on a spring break mission trip to Mississippi while I was in college. I will never forget the sick feeling I had as I stood on a ladder painting a house, while the young, able-bodied men living in the house sat on the front porch and watched. I did so much harm that day. Yes, the house got painted, but in the process I undermined these people's calling to be stewards of their own time and talents. It might have been better if I had stayed home for spring break, rather than to have gone and done harm. Managerial paternalism. Managerial paternalism is perhaps the hardest nut to crack. We middle to upper-class North Americans love to see things get done as quickly and as efficiently as possible. Relative to many other cultures, including many low-income communities in North America, we are prone to take charge, particularly when it appears that nobody else is moving fast enough. As a result, we often plan, manage, and direct initiatives in low-income communities when people in those communities could do these things quite well already. The structure and pace might be different if the low-income communities undertook the projects themselves, but they could do a good job nonetheless. You might be asking, then why don't they take charge and manage these projects if they are so gifted? There are lots of reasons that the people, churches, and organizations in low-income communities might not take charge. But here are several common ones that should give us some pause before rushing into a low-income community and grabbing the reins in any project. They do not need to take charge because they know that we will take charge if they wait long enough. Or, they lack the confidence to take charge, particularly when the superior, middle to upper-class North Americans are involved. Or, they, like we, have internalized the messages of centuries of colonialism, slavery, and racism. Caucasians run things, and everyone else follows. Or, they do not want the project to happen as much as we do. For example, they might know the project will accomplish little in their context, but are afraid to tell us for fear of offending us. Or, they know that by letting us run the show, it is more likely that we will bring in money and other material resources to give to them. There are situations in which a lack of local leadership and managerial ability may require the outsiders to perform these functions. But we should be very, very cognizant of our tendencies as middle to upper-class North Americans to take charge and run things. Remember, the goal is not to produce houses or other material goods, but to pursue a process of walking with the materially poor so that they are better stewards of their lives and communities, including their own material needs. Of course, there are exceptions to every rule. There are times when the Holy Spirit might move us to do something for the materially poor that they can do for themselves. But just remember that these situations are the exception, not the rule. Avoid paternalism. Finding your niche. It is extremely difficult for the same person or organization to provide relief, rehabilitation, and development. For the relational dynamics in each of these types of ministry are quite different. For example, if your church is known as the place to go for free food, relief, it might have difficulty convincing people that they need to start working to earn their daily bread, development. In addition, each of these ministries is demanding. If a church tries to do all of them, it runs the risk of being spread too thin. Hence, it might be better for your church to focus on relief, rehabilitation, or development. How do you decide? Determine the sorts of services that are already being provided by organizations in the community in which you want to serve. Next, find out both the assets and the needs of the materially poor in your community. Are the people destitute, or can they contribute to their own improvement? In many, if not most instances, you will find that the materially poor in your community are not in a free fall, that is, they are not in need of relief. Ironically, you will also typically find that most existing organizations in your community are focusing on providing relief. Why? There are at least three reasons. First, many service organizations have a material definition of poverty. Hence, they believe that handouts of material things are the solution to that poverty. As a result, they often provide relief to people who really need development. Second, relief is easier to do than development. It is much simpler to drop food out of airplanes or to ladle soup out of bowls than it is to develop long-lasting, time-consuming relationships with poor people, which may be emotionally exhausting. Third, it is easier to get donor money for relief than for development. We fed 1,000 people today. Sounds better to donors than, we hung out and developed relationships with 12 people today. In this light, your church might decide to find a niche in development, choosing to focus on ministering intensely over time to a few people rather than superficially and quickly to many people. Indeed, many churches are well placed in terms of mission, programmatic focus, financial resources, relational skills, and basic giftedness for the long and sometimes grinding haul required for development work. After all, the church is designed by Christ Himself to be all about developing and growing people through long-term discipleship. If your church chooses a development niche, it might want to put in its benevolence policies that no more than, say, 10% of the benevolence fund will normally be used for relief work, with the other 90% going toward development. Your church should also keep a list of organizations that do offer relief and rehabilitation in your community, in case you encounter people who actually need it. In compiling such a list, you might try to discern which organizations do relief and rehabilitation developmentally, so that you can feel confident about referring people to them. Not all poverty is created equal. Hence, there is not a one-size-fits-all approach. Take the time to find the niche that is right for your church and your community. Chapter 5. Give me your tired, your poor, and their assets. Now that you've determined whether relief, rehabilitation, or development is the correct intervention, what do you do next? It seems like the next step would be to ascertain the needs of the individual or community in order to determine the best way to help. In fact, many ministries do begin this way, conducting a needs assessment by using an interview or a survey to determine what is wrong and the best way to provide assistance. This needs-based approach has merit, for diagnosing the underlying problems is essential to formulating the proper solutions. However, starting with a focus on needs amounts to starting a relationship with low-income people by asking them, "What is wrong with you? How can I fix you?" Given the nature of most poverty, it is difficult to imagine more harmful questions to both low-income people and to ourselves. Starting with such questions initiates the very dynamic that we need to avoid, a dynamic that confirms the feelings that we are superior and that they are inferior, and that they need us to fix them. Beginning with assets, not needs. For these reasons, many Christian community development experts have discovered the benefits of using asset-based community development, ABCD, as they seek to foster reconciliation of people's relationships with God, self, others, and creation. ABCD is consistent with the perspective that God has blessed every individual and community with a host of gifts, including such diverse things as land, social networks, knowledge, animals, savings, intelligence, schools, creativity, production equipment, etc. ABCD puts the emphasis on what materially poor people already have and asks them to consider from the outset, what is right with you? What gifts has God given you that you can use to improve your life and that of your neighbors? How can the individuals and organizations in your community work together to improve your community? Instead of looking outside the low-income individual or community for resources and solutions, ABCD starts by asking the materially poor how they can be stewards of their own gifts and resources, seeking to restore individuals and communities to being what God has created them to be from the very start of the relationship. Indeed, the very nature of the question, "What gifts do you have?" affirms people's dignity and contributes to the progress of overcoming their poverty of being. And as they tell us of their gifts and abilities, we can start to see them as God does, helping us to overcome our sense of superiority, that is, our own poverty of being. In contrast, needs-based development focuses on what is lacking in the life of a community or a person. The assumption in this approach is that the solutions to poverty are dependent upon outside human and financial resources. Churches and ministries, using a needs-based approach, are often quick to provide food, clothes, shelter, and money to meet the perceived immediate needs of low-income people, who are often viewed as clients or beneficiaries of the program. Pouring in outside resources is not sustainable and only exacerbates the feelings of helplessness and inferiority that limits low-income people from being better stewards of their God-given talents and resources. When the church or ministry stops the flow of resources, it can leave behind individuals and communities that are more disempowered than ever before. Asset-based approaches to poverty alleviation should not be seen as denying the fact that low-income people, like all of us, have glaring needs. Some of these needs emanate from their personal sins. Some result from unjust social, economic, political, and religious systems. And some come from natural disasters resulting from Adam and Eve's sin. Indeed, the fall has tainted every last speck of the cosmos. The point of ABCD is not to deny those needs or the deep-seated brokenness that undergirds them. On the contrary, the point of ABCD is to recognize, from the very start, that poverty is rooted in the brokenness of the foundational relationships and to start the process of restoring both low-income people and ourselves to living in right relationship with God, self, others, and the rest of creation. What is wrong will come out soon enough. But by starting with what is right, we can change the dynamics that have marred the self-image of low-income people and that have created a sense of superiority in ourselves. Once the assets have been identified, it is appropriate to then ask the poor individual or community the questions. What needs can you identify that must be addressed? What problems do you see that must be solved? How can you use your assets to address those needs and to solve those problems? Of course, as the process proceeds, it may become clear that the individual or community does not have sufficient assets to address all of the needs. If and when such needs become pressing, it is then appropriate to bring in outside resources to augment local assets. But gauging the appropriate magnitude and timing of these outside resources takes an enormous amount of wisdom. It is crucial that such outside resources do not undermine the willingness or the ability of the poor individual or community to be stewards of their own gifts and resources. When considering bringing in outside resources, we must always ask two questions. One, is it too much? 2. Is it too early? It would be far better to let a non-emergency need go unmet than to meet that need with outside resources and cripple local initiative in the process. Again, poverty alleviation is about reconciling people's relationships, not about putting bandages over particular manifestations of the underlying brokenness. One of the most difficult dynamics in all of this is that even the belief that outside resources may soon be forthcoming can mask people's true motivations for their behaviors. For example, the introduction to this book discussed a small business class that I helped to initiate in a slum in Kampala. Why did people come to this class? Was it because they really valued the training? Or was it because they believed that jumping through this hoop would increase their likelihood of getting some sort of financial assistance from me? I believe some people sincerely valued the training. But I also know that a number of the participants stopped coming when they became convinced that I was not going to give them any money. Their initial, enthusiastic attendance at the classes masked their true motivation. They wanted money, not training. All of us, myself included, do strange things in the presence of money and power. And in poor communities, the outsiders usually represent both, whether they realize it or not. In summary, ABCD has four key elements. Identify and mobilize the capabilities, skills, and resources of the individual or community. See poor people and communities as full of possibilities given to them by God. And, as much as possible, look for resources and solutions to come from within the individual or community, not from the outside. And, seek to build and rebuild the relationships among local individuals, associations, churches, businesses, schools, government, etc. God intended for the various individuals and institutions and communities to be interconnected and complementary. And only bring in outside resources when local resources are insufficient to solve pressing needs. Be careful about bringing in resources that are too much or too early. Do this in a manner that does not undermine local capacity or initiative. Back to the Bible. The creation, fall, redemption motif outlined in chapters 2 and 3 provides a biblical foundation for thinking about both the nature and relationship of assets and needs in poor individuals and communities. As we discussed, Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 through 17, indicates that the goodness of God's creation includes all things, extending beyond the natural world into the culture as a whole. Our basic predisposition should be to see poor communities, including their natural resources, people, families, neighborhood associations, schools, businesses, governments, culture, etc., as being created by Jesus Christ and reflective of His goodness. Hence, as we enter a poor community, there is a sense in which we are walking on holy ground, because Christ has been actively at work in that community since the creation of the world. This should give us an attitude of respect and a desire to help the community residents to discover, celebrate, and further develop God's gifts to them. And that is exactly what ABCD is all about. Of course, the fall has distorted the inherent goodness of the creation design, damaging the assets. As a result, communities do have pressing and urgent needs. Individual lives are broken. Organizations, associations, businesses, churches, and governments often pursue power more than the public interest. And even local customs and cultures often glorify the profane. But all is not lost. Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 through 17 teaches that Christ is holding all things together. He does not allow the effects of sin to completely destroy the inherent goodness of the assets that He created. In the midst of the decay, the assets persist, albeit in distorted fashion, because the Creator of the universe makes them persist. We do not need to despair. There is plenty of goodness to discover and to celebrate, plenty of ABCD to do, even in a fallen world. And finally, the good news of the gospel of the kingdom is that Christ is not just sustaining all things, but He is reconciling all things. One day, all of the assets, natural resources, individuals, neighborhood associations, schools, businesses, governments, etc., will be liberated from their, Romans chapter 8, verse 21 says, bondage to decay. Jesus Christ created, sustains, and is redeeming assets in poor communities. As the body of Christ, the church should seek to do the same. Muzungu mistakes. We have covered a lot of ground since the introductory chapter to this book. Recall from that chapter that I gave $8 to Elizabeth, a Ugandan church leader, so that she could buy penicillin to save the life of Grace, the ex-witch doctor. I later realized that I might have done an enormous amount of harm to St. Luke's Church and its pastor, to the refugees in the small business class, and even to Grace herself. Consider now all that we have discussed thus far. Why might it have been a mistake for me to pay for the penicillin? How might I have done harm in the process of trying to help? What would have been a more effective strategy for assisting Grace? As you consider these questions, never lose sight of the goal. Reconciling relationships is the essence of poverty alleviation. Grace was clearly in need of relief. Lying in agony on the floor of her shack, she was unable to help herself and needed somebody to provide assistance to her. But was I the best person to provide such relief? Remember a key relief principle we learned in Chapter 4. Respond when needs of the affected population are unmet by local people or organizations or family members due to their inability or unwillingness to help. I never even considered this principle when reaching into my pocket for the $8 to pay for the penicillin. Relief was the right intervention, but I